written in this, so basically in this paper, of which an improved version will appear soon. And this is, in fact, a proceeding of a conference, but nothing really new is written in the proceeding with respect to the main paper, except that there are a slightly different point of view, which I would like to emphasize here as well, and which really has to do with counting the trying to count the degrees of freedom of original speech. I mean, try to address this problem. So, as an invitation to what I'm going to say, let's consider the traditional picture of a QFT with a UV cutoff. So, very naively, you have for any space-time point, for any point in some space slice, you have an harmonic oscillator, and in the presence of a UV cutoff, you've got a finite possible distance between the space-time points. So the UV cutoff acts as a short distance cutoff, and also you've got a bound on the possible energy on this harmonic oscillator. So what you end up is and I find very nice is that you end up with at least if you are in a finite universe, with the totality of the space, which is finite dimension, because it contains a finite number of degrees of freedom. And roughly speaking, the idea is that the number of degrees of freedom is proportional to associated to a volume of space, to a region of space, let's see. So I'm taking a slice at t equal constant. The number of degrees of freedom of some region of space is proportional to the volume. But as soon as gravity is considered in this picture, there are several arguments, classical, that are challenging, in fact, this simple picture. And one is the holographic principle. So if we believe in the holographic principle, we know that the maximal entropy contained in a region is proportional to the area. So to the area of the region and not to the volume. So you may be a bit weird and try to construct a physical state, a maximally entropic physical state, and you would convince yourself that you have somehow to change the Fock space of your QFT in order for the holographic principle to be satisfied. Another aspect is that in order to solve the black hole information paradox, with the ideas of, for instance, of black hole complementarity, and with this new idea here of Orbison, but at some point, at some level, you have to introduce some non-local, you have to suppose some non-local non-local behavior of the fields. Problem for the locality of the field. So the basic fact that all these degrees of freedom should be independent of each other is has been posed by Gibbons and Lippert. They have some arguments according to which whenever you describe field configurations that have a very big back reaction to the metric. So, for instance, field configurations that tend to form closed track surfaces. At some point, the usual commutation relations to break down, and locality itself is challenged. Then there is this hints that the hyperspace, the quantum gravity of the sitter space may be described by a finite dimensional hyperspace. And then again, how the naive picture of localized degrees of freedom can be put together with an expanding space? I mean, shall I dilute these degrees of freedom as the space time expands? Will new degrees of freedom be produced? I mean, this is challenging for the naive picture of the QFT with a unique cutoff again. And this is just an aspect, I mean, a very special aspect of a more general aspect that space-time is dynamic. So again, as this surface evolves, what happens to the localization of the degrees of freedom? Yeah, so of course, one may say, okay, the degrees of freedom are in fact infinite. You may have infinite entropy, infinite information. Whatever, yes, that may be a solution, which is itself, I think, are compatible with the finite entropy of a black hole. And so, I would take as an assumption the idea that I mean the total number of degrees of freedom inside of the original space time may be finite, as at least the entropy of the cold, the holographic principle, the thermodynamics may suggest, seem to suggest.
Of Feyerabend.
Yes.
I mean, in fact, in Toft's first paper on the subject, this word holographic principle was not even created, and its basic observation was long before that paper, I think. Just that the area of black hole, the entropy of a black hole grows with the area according to theory is proportional to the volume. So we don't have to believe in holographic principles. The question is just how to unify the picture of quantum field theory with the existence of black holes. So we don't have to, I mean, refer it to the holographic principle. He didn't do that, right?
Sorry,
I mean, his basic observation, his first paper on the subject, when the word holographic principle was even not created, that came long afterwards, was just that if you calculate the entropy of a quantum field theoretical system, it grows with the volume of the system.
Well, no. Well, the entanglement entropy tends to grow with the area of the system.
Of a quantum field theoretical system?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are several definitions of entropy. The true quantum mechanical one should be the entanglement entropy. I mean, the von Neumann entropy. And this, in fact, since it counts the correlations between the inside and the outside, you can show in many situations that for the majority of the state that you consider, this grows as the area. So, yeah, because it counts the correlation between the inside and the outside. So there are really many papers on this. Of course, it is a diverging quantity, but if you put a UV cutoff again, you got something times the area. The point is, as I said before, that again, you can, so this is for general states, but you can construct by hand a weird state where you really fill up the state with correlations between inside and outside, and then you can construct by hand a state where you maximize the entropy, and this tends to scale at the volume. So it's a weird construction, but you can do it. And then if you want to apply the holographic principle, then you have to change the rule of the rules of the game. So these are traditionally problems for quantum gravity, of course, for candidate theories of quantum gravity. So to a candidate theory of quantum gravity, one would ask for it to be pre-geometric, or well, I would say, if you agree, lead that prismatic is a bit more general than background independent. At least background independent, maybe even prismatic. I mean, if we are able to reproduce even the space-time continuum in some appropriate cross-grain limit, I would say that this is prismatic. And now, the problem, of course, the problem with this construction is, okay, which direction to take? So, of course, I'm listening yesterday to a beautiful lecture on the introduction on how one can quantize a covariant theory in a covariant way. But I mean, the possible directions in principle are many. Also, from the string point of view, there is this this wide belief that in fact there is a unique background independent non-perturbative formulation of a theory, but nobody knows how which form it will have. So I will suggest here not to consider, to try to solve these general problems, at least in a first step, with, say, considering the matter field instead of the gravitational field. So the basic observation of this talk is that any operationally meaningful assertion that we do about space-time, when we say this chair is there, whatever, is in fact, if one translates in what we are really perceiving, is in fact an assertion about the degrees of freedom of the matter fields of the particles of the electromagnetic field. So whatever we can see about space is in fact an assertion about the relations between degrees of freedom of the matter field. So the hope is can we in a sense construct a prismatic of the version of the field of the electromagnetic field and interrogate it and ask it about space time. So the spirit aims to be close to the one of the very first paper of special relativity when Lorentz transformation were discovered. At least as long as I got the spirit of the first paper of special relativity. In a sense, at the very first step, Einstein tried to answer the following question. So what is the Gaussian transformation between the class of natural observers? And what he did, he said, so he used, of course, these two principles, but these two principles were really nothing new at the period. The basic ingredient, I think, was just to find the physical procedure by which the observers assign the coordinates to the events. So, whenever I say the train arrived here at 7, what am I meaning? And if you do it, if you do things right, if you discover that, and you use, of course, these principles, you discover that the correct coordinate transformations between the observers are not the Galileo ones, but that are, of course, Lorentz ones. And these are in Einstein words. I wrote down a couple of sentences from the very first paper. So, the theory of this is based on the kinematics of the rigid bodies. It's assertions of each and any theory concerns the relation between rigid bodies and. And if I see the train arrives here at 7 o'clock, that means more or less that the pointing of the small hand of my clock at 7, the arrival of the other. It's strange that to read this in a scientific paper, but just wrote down what one does when assigning according to an event. So this is the general point of view that aims research. The way, so I think this is very, I think this is very natural in a way. I mean, it's a strategy that deserves to be followed. Well, the particular way in which I try to follow it, that's another cup of tea, and I'm very happy to be here in order to discuss it with you. So the assumption here is the fields, so the physical theories are quantum theories, and at least the ones of the metal fields. We may be pretty sure about this. So in a quantum theory, if you want to know what's going on, while an observer perceives the position of an object, this is, you go back straight to the, in principle, to the quantum measurement problem, because that observer is doing a measurement. That's very bad, because it's a very delicate problem, and of course, as any delicate problem, it's delicate to treat. I will try to introduce a working hypothesis with which you may feel happy or not, but I mean, at least it's a working hypothesis to try to begin to treat the problem that you would like to address. So of course, the problem, why is it a quantum measurement problem? Well, because in the usual interpretation of quantum mechanics, any time you do a measurement, something very special happens, which is not describable with the theory, within the theory. So you have to put by hand a projection of some cat into an eigen state, and of course, this is not describable in terms of a given theory. While the other thing in interpretation says that in fact you have to consider also the hyperspace of the measurer, of the guy which is measuring something, and you describe consistently a measurement as a unitary evolution which increases the degree of correlation between the measure and the measure and the measuring. So another very nice thing of this. Well, so the idea is exemplified in the very simple case of the spin of an electron, let's say. So in the traditional view. In the traditional view, you just consider the hyperspace of the electron, and you are describing the measurement. You describe what is happening to the electron during a measurement in this way. So, of course, the electron can collapse in either plus the probability alpha squared or minus. Nevertheless, you, this is wrong. You should consider also the hyperspace of the measure, and now this process is described as a perfectly unitary evolution, and in fact it is a type of evolution that brings initially uncorrelated states in some suitable correlated state. First of all, these if I believe this view, if I take this view as a working hypothesis, I don't care anymore about who is measuring. I mean, it may be a human being, it may be an electron which is measuring a photon. Every time the correlation forms, then I can say the electron has an information about the photon. And on the other hand, what I find very intriguing, and the next job, I think, for quantum information theorists is doing quite the opposite. So take the Hamiltonian of a physical theory that you know, and a Hilbert space, and try to interpret the evolution into the evolution of the cat into the hyperspace as measurements going on between all the observer. For instance, try to write down which are the possible observable that you have, and the one that for some symmetry reason you cannot construct, because you cannot have some types of evolutions that correspond to some observable. I think this is very nice, and completely pre-geometric in a sense. I mean, because what you need is just it's just a Hilbert space and an evolution on the Hilbert space. So again, in the usual point of view is with a Hilbert space, even if you divide it into subsystems, this is not going to give me anything, no meaning. I don't know what to do with this. As if I don't have a class of operators that represent some observables in this interspace. Now I'm saying, but if you have the evolution of a cat in the interspace, you may try to apply Everett's conjecture and try to interpret and try to recover a posteriori what are the observables that the various observers, these various observers have in the interspace. So I will use as a type of correlation only quantum entanglement, which is basically independent, completely basis independent. So a separable state is a state which can be written as a product. While every time this is not possible, the state will have some degree of entanglement. And so again, I can take the cat of the universe and analyze the entanglement between some given couple of subsystems A and B. Now another interesting problem arises, I think, because usually in quantum mechanics you start with the subsystems, the electron, the nucleon, etc., and then say, okay, the total Hilbert space is the tensor product of these subsystems. But you may also do the opposite and consider a total Hilbert space and think of how many ways you can divide it into subsystems, which correspond to give a tensor product structure to your Hilbert space. So I anticipate that the key would be, I think, try to single out the tensor product structure of the Hilbert space of the fields that singles out localized subsystems, because there is no local. So these subsystems may be absolutely non local. I mean, this may miss the quantum degrees of freedom of an atom on the Earth and of a nucleon on the Moon. And it would be a perfectly consistent decomposition of your system into subsystems. But of course, what is interesting is try to infer in an intrinsic way that decomposition that singles out localized subsystems in order to reconstruct the space there. So in general, a visual entanglement between two general subsystems does not exist. At least there is no a unique and universally recognized measure. So let me sometimes I will anyway mention it. So I will mention a not well defined one of the measure of the entanglement between these two subsystems. But whenever possible, and in most cases, I will just use. I will put the universe into a pure state, so that in this case there is a very well-defined measure of entanglement between one subsystem and all the rest of the universe, and this measure is the von Neumann entropy, von Neumann. So what can we start to do with this with this very abstract beginning? Well, first of all, introduce the idea of space-time coincidence or space-time contiguity. So the idea is if two subsystems have started disentangled of each other, and then at the end they become entangled in some time interval. Then they have, then by definition, they have been space-time coincidence. They've been in touch with each other. Of course, this is supported by the local nature of physical laws, because we know that physical interactions are local, and if you want to interact with something, you have to be there, close to the something. And on the other hand, it explains why physical laws are local. It's just because we define locality by means of physical interaction. In everyday life, I'm close to this object because if I want, I can touch it. It's a bit maybe a philosophical point of view, but I find it very natural. I mean, this space-time coincidence definition, I find it very natural. So more technically, this is the condition. So I consider the entropy also. So now I'm starting with A, which is disentangled with B and is disentangled with everything else. So at the beginning, before some T1, its entropy is zero. Both their entropies are zero. I would say if at T2 their entropy are, let's say, more than zero instead of much more than one. Let's say more than zero. But the entropy of the two have stayed zero during all the process up to T2, then by definition, A and B have been coincident with each other. So now, a naive parenthesis. So I will call one of these subsystem Vincent, and since Vincent is interacting with the outside, he's going to get entangled with the outside, and he's going to. So there is a relation between correlations and information, and let's say that this is translated in bits. The line of information that this completely abstract subspace receives from the outside between T1 and T2, let's say. So again, Vincent can be a human being, but maybe whatever, a subsystem, a factor of our tensor product decomposition of the universe. And the definition of contiguity that I gave was very, very strict, unfortunately, because since we have as a measure of entanglement only the von Neumann entropy, and this is good only for pure states, I define space-time coincidence only for system which started out being entangled, disentangled, completely disentangled, so in pure states. Now, this is very strictly, of course, because we know that I may interact with somebody else, even if I'm already entangled with against somebody else. But again, there is this technical difficulties of defining the quantum entanglement in this case. So it's clear. So what? So if Vincent starts out being disentangled from the universe, he can define a coincidence relation only with the very first bit of information that he gets from the outside. And if these bits of information are significant for him, then he may recognize, I met system A, another system who we call A. So again, he applies this definition of contiguity. And in order to clarify the rule of time in this approach. So of course I start out with an external time, but this external time T, with respect to which the ketter are evolving, is completely a different thing from the time as perceived by the observer. Vincent may have a clock. So we have a system that, for instance, sends regularly, what means regularly, it will be Vincent to tell pulses of information to Vincent. So he knows how to recognize whenever he sees 1010, he knows that he one day has gone by or one second has gone by. Of course, if this is a good clock, it should be recognizable from Vincent at least. And if it's going to be regular, it means that it's predictable. So it's going to give a good account of all the events that, for Vincent, happens with a systematicity. And so this means that itself should be predictable by all the other events. So, of course, there is no, in principle, while the other external time just give an order to this list of bits, this is completely disconnected to time, how it is perceived by the observer, by the things. It's just an ordering. So again, a bit of emphasis on how to define the just a few words with a very basic example. So, how can we consider a given given space as made of subsystems? Well, by giving it a tensor product structure, which means basically in this very simple example of a four dimensional interface, giving it a tensor product structure means putting it in a correspondence to some choose base, which I say, okay, I call these bases plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, and minus, minus. So the degrees of freedom are as many as the many infinite, and are given by the group 84, except that if I do a changing of bases in each of these elements, this is not going to change the chosen tensor product structure. So finally, giving a tensor product structure to this inverse space amounts to choose a group of this element, an element of this group. And for And of course, this group is very used for in the spaces of realistic dimensions. So again, there are many possible directions now. So if I talk, if the tensor product decomposition that I choose for the universe picks out systems which are completely non-localized in space, like the example that I said before, an atom on the heart, the spin of a nucleon, or the isospin of a nucleon on Mars, then these systems, which tend to get entangled, so they will be much more in touch with each other. So the idea is that if they are very unlocalized, they will have very complex and many coincidence relations with each other. So the conjecture is that perhaps the tensor product structure that single out the localized subsystem has to do with the minimization problem. So is the one that minimizes the tendency of entanglement. So the tendency in time of entanglement. So if I start, let's say that I start with a tensor product decomposition. I start with a vector which is a tensor product itself. So every system is not entangled with any other. I make the system evolve in time. And I calculate the entropy, I calculate the entanglement between the subsystems. And the idea is that if these subsystems are localized, this should be the last tendency of entanglement among all the possible TPS tensor product structures that I could have chosen. Of course, so the idea is, okay, space-time has to do with the coincidence relations between the localized objects. We are very far from constructed, I admit. But this is the idea. Let's go back. So I will very briefly skip about the more technical details of the world which were considering a given Heisenberg speed chain model. But again, so coming back to the problem of before, so how distributed are the degrees of freedom? So in the traditional quantum field theory picture, you have from space-time is there from the beginning. You have a cutoff, so your space-time resembles a lattice. And the problem of picking up the subroutine of space just amounts to choose some number of points out of all the points that you have, points of not the lattice space. So if I say, okay, pick me out a region of space of volume M, it will pick up N point. And of course, so from the inner space point of view, associated to each of these points, there is an harmonical oscillator and then a Hilbert space. And it is exactly like if quantum field theory with a cutoff already tells you which is the tensor product structure to give that defines space-time. So tensor product structure already defines space-times, and the only freedom that you have if you want to pick up a region is choose some of these subsystems. Choose this. So you got in this picture only a finite number of possibilities of picking up a subregion, because it's finite, the total number of points at least in a finite universe. So So, but even with this restriction, you see, even with this restriction, the idea of the conjecture of the minimal entangled holds in a sense, because as you said before, the dependency of great entanglement goes as the error, okay? Because it counts the correlation that you can create with the outside. So for a given volume, if you are looking in this, let's say, restricted picture, the traditional picture, for a localized object, you are in fact looking in most of the situations for a sphere. So because it's the shape that minimizes the area. Well, now there is a natural generalization of this. So don't tell me a priori what is the space-time, because I believe that space-time is comes out of the fields and of some particular state which is given of the field. I mean, you give me a field state, and I will tell you how is space-time. And so you, in fact, the minimization problem should be applied among all the possible tensor structures, which are in fact infinite. So it's not just a matter of picking up some point here, but it's just really the problem is back in the hyperspace, and you have to find the tensor product structure that minimizes the tensor entanglement among all the possible tensor product structures. Of course, again, with a given fixed number of degrees of freedom. So now the problem is that not pick me up a region of space which has some volume, because I don't know the volume yet. Pick me up a region of space which has m degrees of freedom. And then I have to choose between all the possible types of product decomposition of this type. Of course, it's not always possible to divide a hyper space. It depends on the dimension. But I mean, for very big hyperspace, I often consider this a problem. So there is an infinite number of ways of considering regions of space time if this framework makes any sense. And okay, so just a few words about the quantum field theory. The very simple model which I consider is a model with fermions. The Hamiltonian is given by a free part and an interacting part. So Fermionic operator has these anti-committing properties. And from these anti-committing properties, the hyperspace is finite dimensional because these are fermions. So every cell can be either excited or not. And in fact, the most natural tensor product structure is this, which means that each site can be excited or not. So this has, in fact, this is a universe with n subsystems, with n is the number of these operators here. You can write a basis which emphasizes this practice for the structure. Since the number of particles for that Hamiltonian is strictly conserved, the space, of course, has also a very strong, since it is strictly conserved, box structure, which is the following, which means that I can consider it as a tensor product, but I also consider it as a sum, as a direct sum of subspaces of zero particle space, one particle space, two particle space, and so on. So now, there is a delicate point. So which has to do with the restriction of all the possible tensor product structures that one can consider on this. I will choose only tensor product structure that preserve this FOC structure. So there is no really a strict justification for this, I think this may have to do with the noiseless quantum subsystem. I believe this has to do with the noiseless quantum subsystem. I'll work on this, I'm planning to work on this soon. But, the choices of the TPS, I will collect, I will express a choice of a TPS by means of a Bobo-Dibble transformation. So I will choose only the TPS that can be expressed as this Bobo-Dibble transformation. So, yes. So this is a huge restriction from all the possible TPSs to a given state. The idea is that, so of course the TPSs may also change in time. The choice of a TPS can be a function of time, because we are not going to give any meaning to the time. There are some reasons why this restriction, I think, if you take it for granted, I will go on and perhaps discuss it later. And so the strategy is, so now I'm into the Fock space. I fix myself in a subspace of the Fock space, because there is no connection between the different Fock space. It's a type of super selection. So I can write the most general state of the system as a density matrix which sums up what happens directly in each of the Fock subspace. So I choose as an initial state a completely factorized state. So this means that all the types of states. So in a given TPS, I choose a completely factorized state. So this means that I can only choose n ones in this tensor product vector. Then I calculate the evolution of the entanglement in the TPS. Technically, I used another definition of entropy, which is the linear entropy instead of the Neumann entropy, because this is similar. So this is a function of the site, which are considered. So I'm considering the entropy between some site and everything else, and I'm evolving with it with this time. And then I apply a generic TPS, and I want to extract the one that minimizes this tendency. So. I'm not considering many details of the world matrix. I think they are not really relevant. The main results are that if I turn off the interaction for free fields, I always can find the TPS that completely reabsorbs the evolution of the system. So really, there is no coincidence relation between anything, because I can always find a TPS dependent on time, such that I start with a completely factorized state, and I end up with the same completely factorized state. So I don't have any communication between the states. But if I switch off the interaction, so the minimization, I didn't find this minimization problem very trivial. What I did is just consider the one particle states, and for one particle states, the same applies. So if I consider one particle states, no space-time relations can be defined. The easiest non-trivial state is the one of the two particle states. And yes, so in the two particle subspace, in fact, found out that entanglement is minimized by the position. So by that Bourguignon transformation, since I started with the Hamiltonian given in the momentum space, you find out that the Bourguignon transformation is a Fourier transform. It is not, of course, a huge result. It's just a starting point, and at least for this simple model, it works. But in general, what I would like to emphasize is that the minimization problem depends on the state of the system. So you take a state, and to that state you apply a minimization problem. So here are the conclusion of the talk. So nothing really new. Again, the point that I would like to emphasize is that the class of localized subsystems should depend on this quantum state that you are considering for the fields. And this is a reminiscence a little bit of gravity itself, because we know that there is a correlation between geometry and the matter content of the fields. So needless to say, the reason why I started this work was the hope that gravity itself could be in a way already contained in the mechanism in our very definition of space-time, so that if I apply the procedure correctly, if I apply the procedure correctly, then I find that space-time is in fact already cured with some properties and so on. So this is it. Thank you.
So this assumption that the TPS has to be consistent with the proper structure in the result must be doing quite a lot of work, because if you don't have that assumption, then surely...
Sorry, it should work or
it's so he's doing quite a lot of work.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that assumption, then, and you allow your TPSs to be time dependent, then it regardless of what kind of quantum you have, you can always choose the TPS to follow the state, so that it remains disentangled.
Yeah.
So, So that's a bit worrying, because it means that this clean idea of the TPS, choosing the TPS that minimizes things, by itself is insufficient to get people to maybe need some additional inputs.
Yeah,
do you have any general comments about that?
Yeah, I think that this is absolutely a good point. And what I would like to do is, again, take an Hamiltonian and analyze its symmetries. And with these symmetries, try to apply Everett's conjecture and see what are the operators that I can define, and which are the observers which can do measurements. So I think that in the presence of symmetries, there is a limited possibility of choosing such operators and such raw observers. And my feeling is that, for instance, the symmetry which worked here was the conservation of the particle number, which gave you the Fock structure. And if you mess up this Fock structure, really, you're talking about something very weird. I mean, but this is the idea. I'm not able to be more explicit than that at the moment, unfortunately.
I'm a bit surprised that you identify three particles with no space time. But take a simple system which is often considered sort of quantum field theory. You have three particles asymptotically coming in, interacting, going out, being free again. mean, in your picture there would mean you have no space-time.
Well, they don't interact.
Some space-time pops up somehow, or at the point in space-time. I don't know how you interpret this, and it goes out. And it,
but this means, I mean, are you talking about particles that interact at some center or not?
Well, they interact at some point. I mean,
yeah, okay, so if they interact at some point, they get entangled, they will get entangled with each other, and they will experience a discontinuity relation. Say, okay, I met the particle. If they don't interact, if you switch off the interaction, they just don't entangle. They are not.
But then, I mean, the interaction becomes smaller and smaller, right? I mean, they become asymptotically free again.
Yeah, but I mean.
So, I mean, how is that? I don't understand that. I mean, is it.
No, the interaction doesn't get more smaller and smaller. I would say that this is how you treat the scattering problems in interacting quantum theory. So, I mean, you just suppose that at some point the interaction gets smaller because they got far from each other, not because you're
But what does far from each other mean in that context? If you don't have space time, what does far from each other mean?
Well, perhaps in close to something else. Yeah, I haven't solved the problem of space, unfortunately.
If I could try to address that, if you have only two particles not interacting with anything, then it doesn't make sense to say I've got space-time, because that's all that exists, just those two particles. In order to say that they're asymptotic, that they're far, that they're traveling with constant momentum and so on, you have to have other matter in the universe relative to which you can define those. And so you need interactions between those particles and the rest of the universe.
Well, the question is already whether the statement that you lack two particles makes sense without space-time. Yeah. Because if you can distinguish between them,
what
you
mean
there's a
particle
relative.
Well, you mean the particle probably.
My understanding is you're studying a chain of spins, and what you meant by no interactions is that they're just a bunch of non-interacting fermions. There's not even local, there's stable interactions, is that right?
Look, interaction has just been a four fermion interaction. So
you mean a four fermion?
Yeah.
So
this is the picture.
But what are the J? What are the J's? Are the J's labeling sites on your Heisenberg spin chain?
Yeah.
So if you turn off the second term, then there's nothing that couples. You don't have anything left in your stable coupling.
I suppose I have it here, because if you write it in the position space, this is exactly a first neighbor coupling, I think.
Oh, well, so the J's are not
so
labeling the site, they're labeling the Fourier.
The moment, sorry, yeah. So sites are generalized sites. But this is written in the momentum space.
Fine, so correct. So if you Fourier transform, then that's the nearest neighbor coupling.
Yeah.
So then it is a little mysterious, because suppose you turn off the interactions, you still have the set of Fourier modes. And so by your criteria, you don't have space, but you still have momentum space.
Well, this is. The levels of position and momentum are just levels, are just the subsystems. There are subsystems, of course. So if I switch off the interaction, there are subsystems. The point is that these subsystems do not have a continuity relation with each other. So there may be, I mean, they don't define space-time relations.
Through your definition, okay,
yeah.
Very good. Okay. So the results that you quoted were for the one-dimensional Heisenberg spin chain.
Yeah.
Good. Can you, just for curiosity, could you do the same thing just on a lattice of higher dimension or
yeah. Well, I would like to. I found this realization problem technically very difficult. I mean, it's I also come from another field, so probably if somebody was already played with some, I mean, for me was a pain. But yes, the idea would be absolute, because of course we don't expect to have any dynamics in a one-dimensional lattice. This makes sense. I mean, I'm not expect to find very strange results in a one-dimensional lattice. But notice that this is not even a one-dimensional lattice. This may be whatever. The dimensionality is given by the form of this vector.
Sure. Yes. I mean, my understanding. I don't know if there's any point of information. In my understanding, the studying measures of entanglement for higher than one-dimensional spin systems already is very hard. Maybe people can do things numerically with two dimensions.
Just entanglement for more than two particles, two systems are different.
Yeah, so it's not. So if you have some criteria based on measuring entanglement, it's already very. So in some sense, you demonstrate your point with a solvable system, but it's hard to compute with. Now, do you envision ultimately I know you wanted to start with matter to find frames of reference and everything through matter, that's your motivation.
Yeah.
But of course, if you fix a lattice, then basically you're making discretization of the fixed geometry.
But in fact, I'm not fixing a lattice. I'm fixing an Hermite domain. So I'm fixing the Hermite domain. I'm not talking about space. About space. This is the Hermite domain. And can be written with the operators which act on the inverse spaces.
And okay, so I'm supposed to take the point of view that it happens that there are examples of this theory where it comes from a particular lattice and
well,
a particular canvas.
So, yeah. So, this is a simple check that if you start with that model, you insert the Heisenberg, instead of this lambda and gamma, you insert the ones that you have in a Heisenberg spin chain of some type. You do the minimization problem and you recover, I mean, what you would call the position basis,
right.
Because so this is the choice. This is the choice of the Bogoliubov transformation with respect to which this is written. It's just the choice that diagonalizes this piece. Okay, so. I'm writing always the Victorian of the system in such a way that this first free term is diagonal. Well, it happens that in a lattice, this is the momentum. This is the momentum. So these are the annihilators and creators of momentum. And so then you say, okay, then I find this this other as the minimizing TPS, and it happens to be the Fourier transform of this. But in principle, this is a Hamiltonian with some symmetries, and that's it. I mean, no mention to space time at all.
But not surprisingly, when you can solve it, the symmetries of the space that you identify come from the symmetries that are derived from the gamma.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But in a general Lubacki space type, there are no symmetries whatsoever.
Yeah, there are no symmetries whatsoever. My idea is that okay, one should invent, of course, but still. Again, if this is connecting, in some representation, so for some TPS, is connecting neighborings, then I can say, okay, well, but if I'm very local, this is Minkowski, more or less. So applied to that batch, that small batch, what we already know about quantum field theory on flat space, right? Use that as a form of the Hamiltonian, but just of the Hamiltonian. And then see if you find the ER effects as you move from the patch. So the form of the Hamiltonian should be suggested by the equivalence principle, in a sense, by the fact that we know that locally gravity does not exist. I mean, locally I can be in cosmic space and see if there's some ER effect as you consider all the other systems. Yes.
Yeah, I think, I'm just thinking along the lines of Dr. Smolin. If the Hamiltonian exists, can I paraphrase your question? Does it presuppose a space time? Does it presuppose a lattice?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, the Hamiltonian exists because it exists an evolution of a cat in a Hilbert space, and the meaning of this evolution is that there is some information exchange between the subsystems. But even before this meaning,
but from a fundamental point of view, your Hamiltonian should be connected to some fields.
Yeah.
And in order to interpret, now this is why I find this question very legitimate, in order to interpret your C's here, you need a connection, or they are related to field operators.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is what you need in underlying space-time.
No, C is a field operator.
Yeah, no, C is a flux space operator.
Well, why does a Hamiltonian have something to do with it?
No, no, fundamentally, I mean, all fundamental theories are formulated in fields, and then you can get the
No,
I'm interested in fundamental, just interested in how you would do this program in a fundamental.
But this is a fundamental, this is a little fundamental theory which tries to derive space.
Okay, I don't want to stress the word fundamental, that's probably a longer discussion, but let's say you want to give this some meaning in some quantum field theory, like the standard one.
Yeah. You got the fields, but you also have a higher structure, which is just the quantum mechanical structure. So your quantum field theory has a state, as a Hamiltonian, as a line, and I'm not saying that I'm able to write down the prismatic version of the Hamiltonian of the standard model. But this is an example of a Hamiltonian of a quantum field theory, and as such, completely independent of space. And you have just subsystems on which these operators act. And that's it.
But I think what's making my answer is greatly related to Lee's question about symmetries. Later on, and maybe something I don't understand. But what I understood you to say at the beginning was that space-time, in a sense, emerges from interactions between matter.
Yeah.
But when you follow this process all the way through to the end, and you get a structure which doesn't require matter in order to have dynamics and non-trivial structure.
The other day you have
space-time described effectively by Einstein's equations,
yeah.
And that doesn't require any matter at all to have non-trivial structure.
So you have the vacuum. So I mean, the propagation of a gravitational wave. The vacuum is a state. It's a state as any other. I don't mean the space to be filled with matter or all the way up. I mean, there may be vacuum regions, but still, I got a state.
It could be absolutely empty.
Yeah.
And still have non-trivial structure.
Yeah. In that case, the state of the quantum field will be the vacuum. But I'm not sure that, okay. So. No? I mean, it's a state that as I have.
Since there's some uncertainty, if someone could say that if that exists, then there definitely does not have to be a structure, then I would be satisfied. Can anybody say that there If that exists, there is no underlying structure. Anybody say that?
Sorry. If that exists,
the Hamiltonian, you're if such a thing exists, can anybody guarantee that there is therefore no underlying structure, that there is no space-time, which is your original assumption? Does that violate your original assumption? Would anybody say that?
No.
It doesn't.
No, you're certainly right. I mean, you're certainly right. You're certainly right. A Hamiltonian that doesn't refer to space, but refer to space-time.
So with Mike Nielsen, I worked on a project which we didn't get very far from yet. So the idea was similar, so we said, so imagine, you know, God creates the world. So what he does is he specifies a dimension for the open space. He specifies a Hamiltonian, and he specifies an initial state.
Mm-hmm.
And then he rests. Can you derive the structure we see out of that? And let's assume he specifies the Hamiltonian randomly.
Yeah.
Which, given what we said so far, just means specifying a bunch of eigenvalues.
Yeah.
Because we didn't specify any bases anyways. There's a problem with specifying a bunch of eigenvalues. And then we try to do some minimization procedure. But rather than looking at example, we looked at what happens when you write a Hamiltonian down with respect to some sensible structure. Okay, and we tried to minimize the interaction to us. We didn't get very far.
That's funny.
But here are the things that worry me about it. The first thing that worried me that you seem to address by picking out the box space structure was that if the TPS can vary with time, then really nothing has to happen. You can always choose a TPS that.
If it's restricted by the Bogomilov transformation, it may happen. It doesn't happen in the case of free fields, and it doesn't happen in the case of one part of the states. But there is a really dynamic, so you cannot act with a TPS in order to nullify the interaction.
I mean, you can choose a TPS that just follows the state of your Hamiltonian, so that
not really.
You can't do it if you put some restrictions on what TPS is.
Of course.
So you didn't think of doing some restrictions. That's an interesting condition. But the other thing that worried me was that even in this approach, you're still treating time on a very different footing to the way you treat space. This is really a pre-space, not a pre-space-time approach, because time, it appears. In the U is e to the I a t, and that t is on a very different footing to any x that you're deriving from this minimization procedure, and that I felt was inconsistent with the sort of spirit of general relativity.
So first of all, there may be a refined version of this. So my comments may be of several types. In my personal opinion, there is a big difference between space and time. And if I get an information from you that is an irreversible process from your observer, and it's just, if you believe this average approach from the point of view of the observers, the one line of information is a non-inversible process. I mean, you got some information. And on the other hand.
So you say that single at a time?
I mean, time is not space, it's something else. Then we have a very beautiful theory which trades time a little bit on the same foot of space, which is a general relativity, but still I can formulate it in a Hamiltonian manner in such a way that I have to choose the space time slices and so on. Mm-hmm. And as a late, and finally, I'm not very sure about this, but if I give you electromagnetism formulated not intrinsic in a covariant manner, but formulated maybe over fashions with the E fields, B fields, so it's formulated with respect to a given inertial observer, and so on. Would you be able, I gave you a theory of this, would you be able to say that there is a balancing invariance? I would say yes. I mean, only with the equations of electromagnetism. I mean, then, I mean, isostatic is even deeper, but so
but there are some barriers to something that kind of emerges rather than being some, you know, some detail.
Yeah, exactly. It emerges from the equations. So even if this, those equations are formulated, I mean, you start with a given time slice, you can start.
Thank you.